The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's good to see you all. So as I said last week, I thought I would open it up to questions tonight. You know, from time to time, I kind of like to see what you want to hear about instead of just me picking the topic every time. So, questions.
Can I ask a question about meditation?
Absolutely.
Okay. I started meditation only a few weeks ago, and at first I found it very beneficial. You know, my anxiety level has reduced a great deal. But during the last 1 or 2 weeks, I started feeling very uncomfortable, you know, inside. And I'm wondering whether I, you know, something that I did not do right, or this is normal.
So let me just make sure, because I missed a little piece of what you said. So you said that at first you just started meditating a little while ago.
Right.
And at first you found it very beneficial, but in the last 1 or 2 weeks you've been noticing some uncomfortable experience, internal experiences.
Yeah, it's not during meditation, it's just during my daily life.
Oh, not during meditation.
Right.
I see. You know, these experiences change all the time. And sometimes what happens when we start meditating is that we get more aware of what's happening for us. And so what you may simply be noticing is an awareness of some feelings that have actually been there that you've not had as much awareness of. Or it's possible there's something going on, you know, something extra or different going on that's bringing up these sensations that you're becoming aware of. It's hard to know just based on what you've said. But what you've said is not unusual, actually. You know, the description of what you've said is not so unusual. So it may just be that you're just becoming more aware of your body and your feelings inside. Are they emotional feelings or...
Yeah, mostly emotional.
Right. Yeah.
So does that mean that I need to pay more attention to my emotion and figure out what it is?
Well, so, you know, if you're noticing this in daily life, the emotions. So there's a whole practice of mindfulness in daily life, and that's actually a great topic. I could talk about that for a while if that's of general interest. you know, when we start noticing emotions that kind of come up frequently in our daily life, it can be helpful to kind of keep your radar out, keep your attention out for those emotions so that you can begin to investigate them. Now, the idea isn't to investigate them in order that they'll go away, but in order to understand them. The Buddha talked about suffering, the experience of dissatisfaction, of unease, of stress, of troublesome emotions, perhaps, that these experiences aren't... The practice around these isn't to get rid of them, but it is to understand them through bringing mindful attention to them. Begin to understand how they arise, what are the causes and conditions that lead to their arising, what happens when you pay attention without reactivity, how long do they last, what's their life cycle like. Often emotions have a kind of a wave-like quality to them. And so you can, with mindfulness, you can just simply watch an emotion kind of come, arise, and then pass away. If you're not resisting it, pushing it away, or trying to change it or control it or manipulate it, it will just have a life. It will kind of follow this wave-like experience. And we can do this in daily life. We can be aware of our experiences in daily life. For daily life practice, I generally like to suggest a kind of a light touch to the mindfulness. You know, in our sitting practice, sometimes we can be a little more investigative of our emotions. You know, we can take the time to recognize, okay, there's the feeling of anger, and how does that impact the body? And so where is there tightness or tension involved in the body? Is that with that feeling of anger? And what kind of thoughts does it produce? And so we can investigate the experience of anger. We can take the time to settle into that experience and just begin to look at it, inquire, what is this experience of anger? Or what is this experience of frustration? In our daily life, it's a little more difficult. You know, you're having a conversation with the boss and a difficult emotion arises and you don't go like, oh, let me look at my body, you know. You need to keep engaging with your boss. So in our daily lives, a light touch to kind of just recognize, oh yeah, anger's happening. And hopefully to... in that recognizing of it, it may help us to not act out of that experience, to be a little more cognizant of what's happening with us. We can make some choices around it. So as we become aware of our emotions in our daily lives, we can recognize which ones are helpful and which ones maybe can and should be acted on, and which ones maybe are more... unskillful, unhelpful, and maybe should be just allowed to have their feeling live their life, but not necessarily come into action around them. And so as we begin to be mindful in daily life of our emotions, we can start to choose more skillfully around how we respond to our emotions. And also, in my own experience, finding that we all have various habits and patterns of responses to our world that is not necessarily so helpful for us. You know, we've learned to be reactive to certain things. You know, we've learned to be frustrated or angry or annoyed or depressed or irritated, or we've learned to try to grab to hold on to things. And so most of us have some kind of patterns along those lines. You know, if you just think in your own experience, what kind of habits, mental habits, do you have? You know, is it the habit of depression or the habit of frustration or the habit of manipulating or controlling? So picking a habit or pattern or perhaps a feeling that comes to you frequently that you want to understand, that you have some interest in understanding. Interest is a really helpful piece for daily life practice. If you have interest in understanding your habits and patterns, that can help support the mind remembering to pay attention when these things happen. So, you know, we can notice a pattern over and over again. Every time a pattern comes up, you know, a pattern of frustration. You may notice that you're frequently frustrated. You're frustrated when you're, you know, talking to your kids, or you're frustrated when you're talking to your boss, or you're frustrated when you're talking to your partner. And so begin to investigate that frustration. You know, just get familiar with the frustration in all these different circumstances gives you a lot of different perspectives on that experience of frustration. And it begins to help us to understand, how does this happen for me? You know, so in my own experience, in picking a pattern and watching it over and over again over the course of, you know, months or years even at times, I've seen that at least in periods or stretches of time when I pick something like that, you know, I say, okay, I'm going to notice when that happens. I'm going to notice when frustration arises. You know, kind of set your intention to have that mindfulness connected with that experience. When I do that, you know, initially it may be that, you know, that experience has come and gone and you remember, oh yeah, I really got frustrated with my kids this morning and I didn't really notice it. So when you notice that you've forgotten, you know, notice that you've remembered about that pattern but haven't particularly paid attention to it, just commit again. You know, just like, yeah, I'm going to just try to remember to connect with that pattern. For me, that recommitting, that reconnecting with, yes, I'm just going to keep trying. I'm just going to keep trying. That's been a really, really important piece of my daily life practice to help me begin to unwind some difficult habits and patterns. Sometimes I've seen that, you know, over a course of a couple of months of looking at a particular habit, that as I really set my intention to do that, that it's like the mindfulness around that pattern or habit begins to get attuned to the fact that that thing's happening. So frustration, for example, you know, if I set my radar out, my mindfulness radar, to pay attention when frustration arises, over the course of a couple of months, it's kind of like the mind begins to notice frustration beginning, because you've got your intention set for it. And it's like every time you recognize the frustration, you learn a little bit more about it, and the mind becomes more familiar with being attentive to it. And so I've seen that it's kind of like the mindfulness kind of picks up on that pattern earlier and earlier in the process, until you may even begin to see the beginning of it, how it's even coming into being, a thought flitting through the mind and a response or a reaction to it. So there's a lot that we can engage with around daily life practice. But, you know, again, it needs to have a really light touch. In my own experience in teaching in daily life practice, teaching daily life practice to others, and in my own practice, I've seen that if I try to have an agenda to do mindfulness, I'm going to be mindful all day long, or I'm going to, you know, hang on to this mindfulness, it ends up just feeling like a burden. And, you know, when something feels like a burden, we tend to not do it. So my own experience is to keep it really light, you know, just kind of, you know, you recognize a pattern. Yeah, oh, there's that frustration. Okay. Just, you know, acknowledge it kind of and take in what you can about it in a light way and then go on with your day. You know, don't try to hold on to that frustration to observe it or try to figure it out, or just take in that experience. It's like gathering data. You know, you just gather a little bit of data about that frustration in that 10 seconds. And then you go on with your day. And then the next time you have an experience of frustration, you get a little bit more data. And over time, this meeting of the experience, meeting with mindfulness of whatever emotions are happening, begins to help us to understand those emotions. It begins to also help us be a little less reactive to them. You know, sometimes we, you know, it's not only that we're having frustration, but we're reacting to the frustration. You know, I hate frustration. I wish this frustration would go away. And so we're adding extra reactivity to it. And so the mindfulness also begins to help us just recognize, oh yeah, there's frustration again. And when we have that kind of a relationship with our difficult emotions, it's much easier for them to just live their lives. When we're, you know, actually actively kind of battling with these difficult emotions, you know, either resisting them, trying to push them away or get rid of them, or justify them, you know, if it's like self-righteousness, sometimes we can be whipping it up for ourselves. Yeah, I'm really, you know, I'm angry and I have a right to be angry about this, you know. So those kinds of things, those kinds of attitudes tend to perpetuate those difficult emotions. But with mindfulness, we can start to see there can be a little bit of space around the difficulty. And in that space, it's not so much of a problem. You know, nothing is actually a problem. The only thing that's a problem is that we think something's a problem. You know, we don't like the way something feels. The problem isn't in the feeling, it's in the not liking of the feeling. You know, unpleasant experience occurs and we don't like it. The not liking, the aversion is the problem, actually. That's where the suffering lies. It's not in the unpleasantness itself. It's possible to experience unpleasantness without reacting to it. And if you can, you know, imagine if you know, had some experience, and there was absolutely no reactivity. You know, a feeling of, you know, churning in the stomach, and no reactivity to that. Would it be a problem? You might then want to take action. You know, that churning in the stomach may indicate you need to eat, or you need to take some antacid or something, but there doesn't need to be fear or aversion or reactivity to that feeling. So I'm not sure if that, you know, that touches, you know, but that was just some thoughts about that. Any other? Yeah. It's helpful to use it because we record, and there also might be somebody who has a hearing-assisted device.
Okay. This is my first time here.
Welcome.
That's why I don't know how things work. I'm a little confused. So you're saying that if the feelings are there and they come and they're, most of them are habits of many years and years of doing the same patterns, but for me, I want to know, then, therefore, how do you apply change?
That's a great question.
Because I don't want to be the same. I don't want to have the same habits, and I don't want them to be right behind me all the time.
So the interesting piece about mindfulness practice is that the mindfulness itself, have you ever heard of, what is it called, the Heisenberg principle? There's this principle in physics where... Or it's actually not just in physics, it's in any kind of situation where science is observing something, that as soon as you put an observer into a situation, it changes the dynamic of the situation. And this is essentially how mindfulness works. So you have these habits and patterns that you've been connected with for years and years. You know, you've been repeating them over and over again, digging the grooves deeper and deeper. But in the past, you haven't really been paying attention to them. You've just been acting out of them. And now the key ingredient here is mindfulness. Bringing the mindfulness into the picture changes the whole equation. But it can't be, I mean, you know, the funny piece about mindfulness is that, you know, if you're bringing mindfulness to a pattern of aversion, for instance, and you're bringing mindfulness to it because you hate that pattern of aversion and you want to get rid of it, that's just your aversive pattern again. And so that's what I was saying about the... so this is again, a way of affecting change, is bringing the mindfulness to our pattern of aversion, not out of aversion, but out of interest, out of curiosity. How does this pattern of aversion come to be? What's happening here? Now, this isn't, you know, the quick fix. This isn't the, you know, the kind of practice that, you know, you look at your anger, pattern of anger once, and then you're rid of it. But I can tell you from my own experience that over the course of, how long have I been practicing now? I think it's about 15 years. Huge patterns have fallen away through this practice of observing. Patterns of anger, patterns of self-hatred, that they have just gotten to the place where, you know, another way that this works, I mean, you asked how does this change work? You know, first of all, bringing the mindfulness in without any agenda is just a shift of pattern. You know, that's a complete shift of pattern. So it's changing the mind. It's changing the way the mind is relating. The other piece to it is that as we bring our attention to something like aversion, we start to see how painful it is to feel that. You know, we actually start to recognize this doesn't feel good. This, you know, this feeling of hating things all the time just feels kind of yucky. And so the mindfulness begins to educate us that these habits that we've been carrying with us actually make us suffer. And so in that recognition, you know, the mindfulness sees that it is suffering, that the mind is suffering over these patterns and habits that it's been carrying with us, that we've been carrying with us. And through this exploration of seeing, you know, a little bit each time, you know, every time the pattern comes up, see a little bit each time, you get a little bit more information. The mind learns a little bit more about how this pattern comes to be each time you see it. You know, so you might notice that you know, that anger happens in particular situations. You're driving on the freeway. It happens a lot on the freeway. And so you may start, you know, noticing a little bit more. Oh, well, what's happening on the freeway? Oh, well, often when I'm on the freeway, I'm rushing. You know, I'm rushing when I'm on the freeway. And I get really angry because I'm in a hurry and all these people are cutting me off and doing these things. But, you know, I'm rushing. Maybe if I left 10 minutes earlier, I wouldn't have that feeling of rushing. And so, you know, we start to learn how we can change. So the mind starts to educate itself through this practice of mindfulness. And it begins to see, the mind begins to see, essentially, that a lot of what happens for us, a lot of what creates our struggles and our suffering, is our own minds. You know, this feeling of rushing or a sense of needing something to be. You know, I need this to be in this way. And we start to see that it's our own mind that is doing the suffering. And when the mind starts to see that it's doing its own suffering, it has a great incentive to let it go. So it seems almost like magic in a way when you're in the middle of it. I mean, I felt like that at times when I see how, you know, just simply over and over again, meeting a pattern over and over again, just seeing it. Sometimes it just kind of fades away slowly. You know, there was one pattern I worked with over the course of several years, a pattern of anger. And, you know, I just kept watching it over and over again, just watching it and recognizing it over and over again. And actually, at one point, it was just like, oh, yeah, there you are. Okay, I'm not going to pay attention to you. I'm just going to put my attention to my feet. You know, it's just like seeing at one point that putting my attention in it actually had that aversive, you know, I need to get rid of you. I need to fix you. I need to change you. It's like, well, that's not so helpful. So, yeah, I see you, and I'm just going to put my attention in my feet on the ground. And I did that for a couple of years. And, you know, over time, I began recognizing that that pattern was arising less and less often. It's kind of like, you know, it would be a week between times, and then 2 weeks, and then a month. And at one point I noticed, wow, I haven't noticed it in a long time. And it's never come back, that particular pattern, that anger around that particular person. It's gone. It's gone completely. And it's kind of like a slow wearing away. You know, that it's a gradual change much of the time. I mean, for me, there's a real strong resonance with the notion of a gradual enlightenment. You know, a gradual awakening, I guess, is the Stephen Levine book, A Gradual Awakening. For me, that feels like most of the way my patterns and habits have fallen away is really gradually. There's an analogy, I'm sure I've used this many times, so many of you have probably heard this analogy that the Buddha uses around how this path works for us. And he uses an analogy of a shipwreck, and that, you know, if there's the parts of the ship strewn along the beach, you know, there's the rope and the wood and all the different parts of the ship hanging out on the beach. And day after day, the wind, the sun, the sand wear away at these parts of the ship. And day by day, you're not going to see much change. You know, day by day, it looks like that rope is just the same. So it doesn't look like there's much change happening day by day as we bring our attention mindfully to our patterns. Yep, I see you. I've been observing this impatience for months now. Yes, I see you over and over again, just over and over and over and over. But it's this gradual wearing away. And, you know, you come back to that shipwreck a year later and try to pick the rope up and it falls apart. The rope falls apart. There's also an understanding of this from neuropsychology as well. You know, the habits in our mind you know, they're like neural networks, right? You know, it's like there's a neural network that's really wired strongly. And the understanding about the way these neural networks is the more they fire, you know, so a habit of frustration, the more that habit of frustration fires, the more neurons come in to support that pattern. So it shores it up, you know? Yep, this must be really important, so we'll make sure that this pattern has a lot of support. And so it gets to feel like the place where that rut gets really deep. You know, you get anywhere near the edges of it and poof, you fall into the rut. You fall into the rut of frustration over and over again because, yeah, it's been really important. You've kept doing it over and over again. And so mindfulness begins to change the equation a little bit. And I'm not exactly sure how, but, you know, it does activate different parts of the brain, and so it may, you know, kind of take some of the interest out of that pattern, of that neural network. But also, you know, that example I gave of the anger of, yep, I see you, I'm going to pay attention to my feet. Yep, I see you, I'm going to pay attention to my feet. I did that for months I did that. And, you know, kind of, I see that it might be that another thing about those neural patterns is that when they're not engaged with, you know, if you don't go down that path of frustration, those neurons start to decide it's not so important to be supporting that pattern anymore. And so the non-engagement with a pattern, you know, recognizing it, yep, you're there, not gonna engage, not gonna, you know, shore that pattern up, just turning your attention away from it, kind of allows the mind, the brain, to rewire itself. So those are just some thoughts about how change happens. Yeah, in the back.
There was a woman who spoke, and I cannot remember her name, here maybe a month or two ago, who talked about a time in her life when everything was falling apart, and I'm not sure if she used the word, but her depression was so absolute that trying to use mindfulness, she just had to let it go.
Yeah.
And something that seems to happen to me is a sort of negative feedback loop. So that often when I sit, I can just feel I'm getting more and more and more uncomfortable
mm-hmm.
through the process.
Uh-huh.
And so the pattern for me has been, okay, there's something about this that really appeals to me. I'm going to give it a shot. And I try and...
About the meditation that appeals to you?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I try and... you know, I just bounce back off. You know, it's like I hit a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Each time it's like, oh, that hurt. Okay, well, yeah. I'm not going to do that for a while.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then, well, you know, this is what you need to do if you want to develop mindfulness. Okay, try it again. And
so
a little ways and...
Say a little more about what you're bouncing off of.
Pain.
Pain? Physical pain?
Often... in my back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the beginning of the sit, you know, I can feel some tension and things like that. But as the sitting goes on, I become focused on that. And, okay. Tension. Bam. Oh, tension's worse. You know?
You know, working with pain can be... It's a delicate art to work with pain. I mean... Pain can be a great object if you can be with it without any resistance whatsoever. But one of my teachers says, you know, if you're experiencing any resistance at all to physical pain, you should not even try to pay attention to the physical pain. Pay attention to the resistance. The resistance is a mental experience, not a physical one. And so, you know, and sometimes we can't even do that. I mean, sometimes the resistance is so strong, it's overwhelming, and we kind of just have to turn our attention elsewhere. So I kind of have a rough technique or that I suggest for people working around difficult experience. So first, as you are working with it, you know, see if you can be mindful of it. You know, like you've said, at the beginning the pain isn't so strong. You may be able to notice the tension without any kind of sense of tightness or pushing away around it. And if that's the case, then, you know, that's fine. You can notice that. If any kind of resistance creeps in, any kind of, I don't like this, begins to happen, then let go of trying to pay attention to those physical sensations. And instead notice the feeling of not liking. That feeling of not liking will probably be manifesting somewhere else in your body. You know, there may be a kind of a, you know, you may be tightening your hands or clenching your teeth or something, you know, that's manifesting around that not liking. See if you can just notice that. Notice the not liking side of it. And if the whole thing is overwhelming, you know, with physical pain, if it's so strong that it feels like you cannot be mindful of it, what I like to suggest for people then is to say, okay, well, see if you can just know it's fine to move. You know, it's not a problem to move. You know, mindfulness isn't cultivated on pain or on stillness necessarily. It's cultivated on anything in our experience. So, you know, we don't have to use pain as our meditation object. We can use pretty much anything. And so if you notice that the pain is beginning to be overwhelming, then see if you can hang out with it for just like a few seconds and then move mindfully. You know, allow yourself to adjust to a new posture. You know, it may be that you need to sit with your back supported. Even do lying meditation. I do lying meditation. On retreat, I do almost exclusively lying meditation because I have back problems. So it's fine to do lying meditation. Let yourself be in a posture where your back is not, you know, getting worse. So let yourself move, but move mindfully. Allow the movement itself to be what you attend to, you know. So, you know, for instance, if I'm sitting here and my, you know, I notice that my knee has started to get really aching, you know, a lot of pain in my knee, I might sit with that pain for a little while, notice the resistance, notice the aversion, and then after a certain point, it's like, no, you know, this is basically telling me I need to move. And so at that point, I might be mindful of the movement. And one way I like to play with this, mindful moving, is to see, you know, not to try to decide what I'm going to do to move, but just kind of see, okay, if I need to move my knee, so what I'm thinking about here is moving this knee to bring it up, draw this knee up. What's the first thing that moves? And move kind of slowly to do this. So what's the first thing that moves? So for me, it's going to be this hand. So I'm going to move this hand and put it back here to lean on it. And then so you can move in a mindful way. Now, does it speak to you to think about being in a different posture?
I can change postures constantly throughout the whole sitting. But just to give you a little bit more information, there's definitely an emotional component to it.
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, the back, the pain is being expressed in the back. What you said about paying attention to the resistance, you know, not the actual symptom.
Uh-huh.
But the mental experience, that sounds like something good to pursue.
Uh-huh, good, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a really interesting exploration there. Yeah.
So I can just tell a little story. I think last week you were talking about karma and compassion, and you gave the examples of insects. I had an experience that still doesn't make sense to me. I was driving to work, and, you know, mosquitoes are starting to come out. And I saw an insect that looked kind of like a mosquito. And often I will try to kill a mosquito because I don't like the sense of discomfort once they've had some of my blood. But I thought, you know, I'm going to let this one go. So I just rolled down the window, and it dutifully crawled over onto the outside of the window. And I wasn't up to freeway speed at that point, so I closed the window, and I forgot about it. And I drove for maybe, I got on the freeway and drove for maybe half an hour at like 65, 70. I glanced out the window, and it's still hanging on. I mean, when I let it out, I was like, oh, this is great. You know, you're going to be free. You're going to fly away. Freedom, yay. And it still wonders me. Why was it hanging on?
We can't answer that question. You know, we can't answer that question. You know, that's
And how?
Well, that we can't answer these questions.
Yeah,
I mean, the part of the whole thing around karma is that I think, as I said last time, there's so many different pieces that come together. You know, things about the mosquito itself, things about the pattern, the way the wind blows over your car. You know, I don't know, but we can't. So there's no necessary. I mean, it's not helpful sometimes to ask that why question. You know, because the number of different conditions that come together for something like that to happen are so vast that the Buddhist said, if you try to contemplate the extent of it, you'll go mad.
The thing that I'm realizing, though, is that what changed the dynamic is if I had killed this creature, it would have been a smudge on my window. And that would not have been a very interesting experience. But by trying to let it do what it does, it turned into something that still amazes me.
Did it fly away once you stopped?
You know, my attention only comes in very brief bursts. And so about a half an hour later, I was at work, and I was like, oh, it's gone.
I thought there might be some karma questions. Yeah, in the back.
I guess I thought I'd tell a story too. So I was at Tai Chi last week on Thursday, and I brought my 6-year-old son like I did to meditation last week, and he was really good for 10 minutes following everybody, and he started to freak out, and then I didn't know what was happening, and he says, there's a bug, and I said, no, I think it flew away, and then he just got more excited, and then the teacher came over and said, is it a bug? And he goes, yeah, it was a bug, it's over there, and I looked, and I realized it was a wasp, and it looked like it had a stinger or something. So the teacher says, the teacher didn't say anything yet, I took one of his pamphlets on the table and I swat it. And then the teacher said, just squish it. So I did, and I put it in the garbage can, and then he turned to the class and he joked, I guess Laura's not a Buddhist. and then all I felt guilty for a second, and then I said, oh no, but it was, you know, a bee. It was a bee, because I felt like I was justifying it. So, and he came over and looked in the garbage, and it was actually still moving around. Even though I squished it, I was surprised.
So, you know, in a situation like that, you know, you may need to take care of your family, you know. but, you know, there are some other ways. I've got this way of, I usually get something, like you could use even this, you know. Capture it like that. And then you need a piece of paper to slide underneath. And then you take that whole thing outside and watch it fly away. I did this in my house with my parents. My dad was going after a wasp with a fly swatter, and I was like, I'd really rather we caught it and put it outside. And he said, but you're going to get stung. And I said, no, here. And so, you know, I did that trick. I got a cup and I got a piece of paper and I slid it under it and I put the wasp down outside and I made sure that it was oriented away from me so that when I lifted it up, it would fly that direction. And what was so cool about that was that a couple days later, my dad, I came home and there'd been this lizard in the house. And they'd been trying to cat, you know, to get rid of this lizard for a while. And in Tennessee. And we came home and there was this bowl on the counter. And my mom said, what's the bowl doing on the counter? My dad said, that's what I used to catch the lizard and put it outside. And so he had, you know, seen the, you know, he'd used my technique for a lizard. And I was so touched that he had done that. So. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. So I try not to kill insects as much as possible. Victor.
On retreat, I was impressed. The cooks, Nancy and Greg, in one of the Hidden Villa retreats, the ants had overrun the kitchen. And the cooks are on a pretty tight time schedule. And I was wondering what they were going to do. And I thought like they would be expedient and sort of sweep them away. But Nancy just said, well, I just removed everything they may want. So they just have to figure out, you know, the scouts will figure out there's nothing there for them. They'll relay the message and they'll leave. And they left. She didn't have to kill a single ant. I was so impressed. And the dinner or lunch, or I forget the meal that was being prepared, was served on time. And it just, the equanimity that she had in just, oh, this is happening. And she was on a retreat and she was part teacher there. And so she really just held that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Do no harm.
And you know, it's amazing how that works too. I mean, I have had times where, I had been having a lot of trouble with ants in my kitchen. At one point, and one day, one morning, I walked into the kitchen, and there were ants everywhere, and there was like a band of ants this wide, all around the ceiling, and they were just, and I just walked in and I said, you know, I'm going to give you till the end of the day to get out of here, and then I'm going to have to do something about this. And I got home, there was not one ant in the kitchen. I don't know what they were doing, but but I didn't have to kill any of them.
But if they were there, what would you do?
There's a technique that I have for getting ants out of my kitchen. It does end up damaging some ants, killing some ants, but you know, so I usually, I try to find out where they're coming in, and then it depends on, you know, what the scenario is, but, you know, so I try to find out where they're coming in, and then I, like if they're on my counter, I will corral them with soap. I'll put a whole corral around the whole colony of ants, and then I'll slowly make that corral smaller and smaller, so it's kind of working them back to where they can come in. Sometimes I'll scoop them up and put them closer to their hole. Sometimes I'll scoop them up and put them outside. I mean, I think there's a big ant colony underneath my backyard, you know, so I think it's all one colony. So hopefully they find their way home. But yeah, I try not to kill them. I try to not kill them. And then what I have done, you know, when it's gotten really bad, I have at times, once all the ants are completely gone, I'll put a barrier spray down. so that they won't cross into the kitchen. But I don't spray the ants directly. So those are some of the ways that I've done it.
Okay, I have a question.
Okay.
You won't believe it when I tell you this anyway. But I run a company, a software company. And as the CEO of the company, I have to make some decisions that people don't like. And sometimes I have to make decisions that are, you know, affect people's jobs. So is that bad karma when I have to make decisions about, for example, getting rid of people?
You know, the karma has to do with the intention behind it. So, you know, there can be different intentions that go behind that action. Mm-hmm. You know, the intention may be, you know, this person is a waste of money. I don't think this is a good, there may just be some aversion or something going on. And if you're acting out of that aversion, then you're reaping, you're planting seeds of the aversion, the karma of aversion. If you are, you know, you genuinely feel like, oh, you know, I wish I didn't have to do this. You know, this, I mean, businesses are businesses, right? I mean, firing people is not unethical. It's part of the business. Now, if you're firing somebody and there's a sense of, you know, the compassion behind that, you know, that's a whole different kind of karma. You know, there's good karma and there's bad karma. I just want to make that clear. Last time, you know, this, like, there's the karma that leads us toward suffering. The karma out of that, the actions of greed, aversion, delusion leads us towards suffering. When we act out of generosity, out of kindness, out of compassion, those tend to lead us towards happiness. Now, there are, you know, people are going to suffer based on those actions if you have to fire somebody. But it's not, you know, it's not, it's the intention in your heart that is the key there.
I think that it's, well, at least in my experience, it's always been, you know, it's hard for the person, of course, that is having it happen, that it's happening to. But it's also really hard for the manager.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you've got any kind of compassion at all, a lot of times you lose sleep.
Absolutely.
For several nights,
yeah,
before you have,
yeah,
to do what you got to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other thing, the other question I have is, being in business, especially in what I do, you have to be extremely competitive. And I mean, you want to win, and you want to beat the other guy. So, you know, the intention is that they lose, we win.
But are you acting in any unethical way?
No.
You know, it's, yeah, like, it's not, you know, yeah, if your product is better, mm-hmm, in creating, you know, if you're not trying to somehow, you know, denigrate their product, say, mm-hmm, you know, that's bad, yeah, you know, they have a really bad product, you know, but you're, mm-hmm, instead saying, you know, here's our product, this is what it does, here's, mm-hmm, how it does it, you know.
That's all good.
That's business. I mean, that's not, you know, that, again, it has to do with, there, it sounds like there may be some greed there that you might want to look at.
I'm guilty of that. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, noticing that, you know, yeah, notice how that makes you actually feel.
That's a really good point. I can't deny that it's there. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
It's
So it's not to try to deny it, but turn to look at that feeling.
I try.
Yeah,
just ever since I've been coming here, I've been trying to do this.
Yeah, but don't look at it necessarily as something that you need to get rid of. Mm-hmm. Think of it as something you want to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, get interested in that greed.
Yeah. You know, I'm heavily attached to it, and you know, I've tried to become detached to. You know, the money and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And look at it, it's just a tool.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But still, I think, the people, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, the purpose of a business is to make money, and the more you make, the happier the people are that are involved with it, and it's sort of a negative feedback system that sometimes has good benefits.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole notion of, you know, money being what we're living for is something to question. Mm-hmm. You know, that's mm-hmm. money doesn't ultimately make us happy. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes us happy in the short term. Mm-hmm. It's got that capacity where, you know, if we've got money, then we can buy things that we like, we can, you know, have a house that we like, and, you know, so we can kind of begin to arrange our world to be in a certain way. But we find that, you know, ultimately that isn't what makes us happy, you know? So, you know, looking at some of those...
Here's what happens, I think, in business. At least this is what happened with me. Okay, you make the money, and that's fine, that's great, okay. You get over that. What you get addicted to is winning. That's really what you get addicted to.
So that's something to look at.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at that piece.
Yeah, and then when you lose, you feel lousy. So, you know, it's
so there's an, it sounds like there's an identity formed around the being the one who wins.
Of course.
And, you know, it's that identity that's suffering when the losing happens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when you lose, you feel terrible, and you know.
So I would like to propose actually that you actually don't feel that good when you win either. I mean, there's a kind of a tightening that happens around that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like.
Well, I'm trying to find this balance, and there's got to be a balance in there somewhere.
There does,
And I'll figure it out if I keep coming here. I'm sure everybody's here.
Keep noticing. I mean, you might when I at the beginning of the class I was talking about picking something, you know, that's a habit. Mm-hmm. You might pick this feeling of wanting to win. When does that come up? You know, when do you notice that strongly coming up? You know, that do you notice it when you see the ads for your competitor? Mm-hmm. You know, oh, I've got to find a better ad. I've got to, you know, notice when it happens. Just be interested in it. Mm-hmm. Not to try to say, you know, you're trying to get rid of it, but just start to get interested in it. Mm-hmm. The mindfulness itself will be the lubricant that mm-hmm. begins to educate you about how to let go skillfully.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you use it so well. I get to work and I say to myself, you know, I'm gonna do this mindfulness stuff. You know, and I've read books. I've read like Thich Nhat Hanh's books on mindfulness and stuff. And I'm like, I'm gonna use this stuff. And I'm in there and I'm in the office, and within 30 minutes, it's just out the window. I mean, I'm just doing stuff. You know, and I'm not really spending enough time thinking about, you know.
Well, see, this is where
analyzing what I'm doing,
picking some one thing like. This pattern around winning mm-hmm. can help, because if you're trying to just be mindful all day, it's going to go out the window.
Okay.
Pick something and just keep resolving mm-hmm. over and over again. Oh, I forgot. You know, you might notice, oh, going to bed at night, I forgot all day long to pay attention to that thing. Just resolve. Yep, I'm going to keep trying. Just keep trying. Keep trying. Anytime you notice you've forgotten, that moment is a moment of mindfulness. Mm. Take in what's happening then and there and resolve again. I'm going to keep trying. Mm-hmm. That will really help to make inroads.
That's good. So. It's all good stuff.
So we need to stop. Thank you for your questions. I'll see you next week.